You want to know why it's still winter in Wisconsin? I'm sure we have the answer, men, right here with our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's also a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. John Martin, a professor and also chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Our guest, Steve, great to see you.
It's great to be here indoors out of the cold.
John Martin, John.
Good to see you, Larry. I agree with Steve.
Nice yeah, to be what the heck is going on here? You know, here we are the last week of March. You know, last year we had, in southern Wisconsin at least, we had 80 degrees.
Five times.
Yeah.
And nearly five three times. Other times. Yeah. Yeah. So last March we were 16.7 degrees above normal for the month. Right now, we're 7.2 degrees below normal for the month of March. So that's 24 degrees difference in the perturbation in consecutive years. We were talking about on the way over, we don't really have an easy way to determine whether this is true or not, but it must be true. That's got to be an all-time record for the biggest one-year swing from one month to the, from one, you know, a month and one year to the next. It's got to be.
And I'll tell you, everybody's remembering this. I mean, I was getting groceries the other day, and, you know, the guy was just making chit-chat, not knowing who I was, and was just talking about, yeah, can you believe it? Last year?
Yeah.
At this time, it was 80 degrees, you know? I went to Easter in a T-shirt. You know, it was just like, oh, yeah, that's different. You're going to wear one today?
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, but underneath another coat.
Yeah, usually on Palm Sunday, every year I usually play a round of golf with my father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
would have been real easy last year. And this
a little tough this time to find that white ball.
Man.
Oh, well, we can talk some more about that. Mark in Green Bay, actually, though, has a pretty interesting question. I think... thanks for calling, Mark. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity. There was an article in Scientific American a couple months ago talking about the coming mega floods. It regarded atmospheric rivers that flow across the Pacific, actually all the oceans of the world, and they're a fairly recent discovery. And I'm wondering if there's been any coordination that shows that these rivers of moisture, which are 40, 50 times the flow of the Mississippi River, ever make it into the upper Midwest.
Oh, yeah, they sure do. They're more commonly the case on the West Coast because, as I think the article points out there, they tend to be better organized over the ocean basins. But we have the Gulf of Mexico to our south, and so there are occasionally times where, I think one time, let's see, March 1st and 2nd, or May 1st and 2nd, 2007 maybe, or 2008, was a famous flood in Nashville, which was undoubtedly related to one of those types of events. I've got a graduate student who's doing really excellent work on that case right now, as a matter of fact. So, yeah, they do find their way into the Midwest and occasionally into the upper Midwest. There's no doubt about that.
Well, and
am I still there?
Yeah.
Yep.
There was a flood in 1861 that took California from the most prosperous state in the Union to bankruptcy. It flooded the whole Central Valley, I mean, for months.
Mm-hmm.
And did that... it rained for 47 straight days. Do you have any kind of information that shows that the same thing happened in the upper Midwest? Did we have snows for 47 days that could have carried on through the same system?
No, probably not. And in fact, if one had really detailed records for the California event that you're talking about, you might see that within those 47 days, there were several really high-intensity rain events. And then they were sprinkled in amongst a period of kind of general overcast. Probably was in the month of March or February. That's a time of year where it tends to be a little bit cloudier in the valley than any other time of year. But we're exactly 100 years downstream from the famous Dayton flood, where the great Miami River went over its banks in Dayton, Ohio. And that was a five-day straight heavy rain event. And I'd be willing to bet my whole fortune, $10 or $12, though it may be, that... That event was triggered by something much like what was involved in the Nashville flood. So one of these river-type structures.
There we go. Mark, thanks.
And I got to say that I'm a little biased against the word atmospheric rivers. You could see it in satellite imagery, and they look like rivers, but it's not like a flood of liquid water going through the atmosphere. It's mostly water vapor that's being transported that can then be converted into precipitation.
That's right.
So I don't like the coining of that term.
Yeah, and it's
a
really good
point. Some of my colleagues did.
I agree with you very much, and I think the idea that these things are seemingly coming out of nowhere and no one knew anything about them before is also a misnomer. It's not quite accurate. And it's not a fire hose thing, as Steve's pointing out. Not at all. A lot of processes have to do something to that water vapor to turn it into heavy rain. That's very true.
Huh. Thanks again. Nate in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Nate. Thanks for calling.
Ask you guys about, you know, what is the take in the scientific community over the polarization that has occurred in the last 4 years about climate change? Because there used to be a solid majority of Americans across all demographics that accepted the reality of the science. And one of the very interesting little nuggets that I picked up was David and Charles Koch poured tens of millions of dollars in the mobilization of the Tea Party, and they were handing out climate change denial literature at every single one of those events. Mm-hmm. And what you now find in polling is that evangelical Christians, and there's an 80% overlap between them and the Tea Party, and very conservative Republicans now, by, you know, large pluralities, deny the absolute science. You know, there's a consensus on the issue. And it's like, how does the scientific community respond to that?
So, yeah, I think the response has actually been interesting over the last couple of years and maybe slow to respond. But there's a lot of networking going on and now among scientists about how do you communicate to the public in particular about climate change without generating knee-jerk reactions to information they may already have, whether it's, you know, far on the right or far on the left politically. So there's a lot of conferences, a lot of email, a lot of listserv groups where people go through and exchange the research that they're doing and the things that they're trying out.
It's really interesting. Before you gave some of the details about the public relations campaign on the side of sort of denying the issue at hand, that would have been my answer. I would have said I think it's probably been the triumph of a public marketing campaign, not really a triumph of alternative ideas. And I think that that's a fair statement to make, and I'd stand by that. It's probably true in the long run, though, that ideas always beat marketing strategies. They don't always win in the short term, but they always win in the long term. And so one of the things that I like to say to my friends who might be skeptics is I say, well, who's walking around the planet right now predicting that it's going to get cooler in the next 100 years? Nobody. And they don't want to do that because they know it stands in the face of all the evidence to the contrary. Another thing is talk to the insurance and reinsurance industry experts. They're not putting their money on a global cooling. They're putting it on a global warming, and they're paying real attention to what some of the science is saying because they want to make sure they cover the risk as best they can. So there's ways to get around the successful short-term marketing campaign, but there's no way to get around ideas, and there's no way to get around evidence in the long run.
Just thinking about my own department, life sciences communication, a couple of our professors are sort of like international authorities on how to Dietram Scheufele and Dominique Brossard, on how science needs to communicate its findings better,
right? Yeah,
to the publics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and we're not talking about public relations here. We're talking about how do you communicate solid research information in a way that.
Yeah, they've done interesting work, too, about, you know, even just words that we use as scientists all the time, you know, like uncertainty to us is not a, you know, we're always uncertain about what we do.
Right.
But that means something else to the public. It means like, oh, you don't know. And it's just like, well, no, it's not that we don't know. We just, you know that there may be some fine tuning that needs
to be
done.
That's right. And you want to keep your headlights on. You can't be sure you know everything. And in fact, when you say you're uncertain, it's a demonstration of humility in the face of complication. And sometimes the other side doesn't want to do that.
Yeah. Michael in Hillsboro, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking this call. I always enjoy this segment.
Thank you.
I've done a little bit of Bible study, and it's come to light in some of the Bible studies that I've done that in the Mediterranean basin, what we call Asia Minor, perhaps, the areas around Turkey, that there are cities mentioned in the Bible, biblical times, 2,000 or so years ago, that were seaports. And at this point in time, the remnants of those ancient cities are miles from the coast.
Yeah.
Now, either I've been misinformed, or we're looking at some sort of a cycle there, aren't we?
Yes. I'm trying to think of what...
I can't name a city in particular. Caesarea comes to mind, but I'm not sure that's one of them.
Yeah. And how far back does it go? Because,
we're talking Christ's time. We're talking the Gospels.
Yeah, so 20,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So these places were on the Mediterranean coast, and now they're miles from the coast. So the Mediterranean must have shrunk, or the land rose.
Or there could, and this would be part of land rising as well, is deposition of soil to increase the length of the shoreline as well. And part of the rising and the lowering of the sea level or the Mediterranean level would also be a function of, well, with the Mediterranean, I mean, all that water comes in and out through the
Straits
of Gibraltar,
yep.
Right? So if there was stuff going on there as well,
that's right.
Would determine how high they get.
That's right. The Minoan civilization south of Greece was destroyed by volcanic activity as well in the 3000 BC era or 1800 BC, something like that. And so I know that it's a very volcanically active part of the world as well, the Mediterranean basin. So there's a lot of various geophysical processes that might conspire to change coastlines over a couple of millennia,
yeah.
Just like you're saying.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our guest today as we talk with them about weather and climate here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hoping that we eventually, that snow going to ever go away?
I'd say July. It's going to be really
snow-free. There's no doubt that by July 1, there'll be no snow on the ground here. There's no doubt about it.
This is why forecasting climate is sometimes easier to do than weather.
I'm looking at my driveway, and the piles of snow are still 4 feet almost.
I know.
Monona Bay ice thickness is 20 inches.
Wow.
It's thicker. The Monona Bay ice is thicker than what it was in January.
Oh, man. Well, we'll take up the issue of when is spring going to really come right after a look at the news here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Grammy-nominated jazz pianist Gerald Clayton brings his trio to the Town Center at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery in Madison on Saturday, April 6th at 8 p.m. As a composer and performer, Clayton's award-winning sound has been praised in Jazz Times and the Los Angeles Times. For more information about the Gerald Clayton Trio, presented by Wisconsin Union Theater at a venue near you, click on WPR.org/Madison. Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, committed to keeping Wisconsin and the nation green through sustainable building, offering environmentally friendly design through consulting, construction, and technical service to America for more than 120 years. Information at bolt.com.
Well, here we are in the last week of March. A year ago, a lot of us were happily biking to work in 70 or even 80 degree weather, and we'd been out in the garden for a few weeks already, and we were grilling up dinner. What a difference a year makes. This time around, most of us haven't even spotted a crocus yet. Winter boots still parked next to the door. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our weather guys from UW-Madison are with us. They'll try to explain what's going on. They're here until 12:30 today. Very happy to answer your questions when you call in. That's 1-800-642-1234. Don't forget our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of my Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show. You can post comments and weather photos. We love the weather photos. Like the page. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. And we'll be back right after the news. Well, last year we had an incredibly warm March. Felt more like early summer than early spring throughout the state. This year it's hard to imagine as we still bundle up every morning to head out to work or school. Larry Mueller here, lucky to have a monthly visit from our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, John Professor and Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, also a professor in John's department. So it's great to have them here, and hopefully you have a question or comment, you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. If you have a great weather photo, we always love those. Go to my Facebook page. You can post it there at the Larry Mueller Show. You could also post questions or comments there as well. And Mary in Ontario, Wisconsin, up next with a comment. Let's go to her. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just had a quick comment that last year on the last day of March, we were eating asparagus from our garden.
Oh.
And this year I look out and the garden is still under a huge blanket of snow.
Yeah.
What a difference, huh?
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, though. Right? Just looking on the bright side, in April of last year, did you lose anything to frost or freeze?
We lost our whole apple crop.
There you go.
That was the down part of last spring.
Yeah. That's good. Point, though.
Better for us to wait a little bit this year.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah. I agree.
Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, Nate in Dickeyville. Hi to you.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is concerning the moisture levels from last year. I manage a bar in a very rural area of Wisconsin. And of course, I get a lot of farmers. So their main concern is about moisture levels from last year. And we got a really nice rain a couple weeks ago, but it didn't soak because the ground was so frozen.
Yep.
However, in the low-lying areas, we're very flooded. So my question is, how are we doing on moisture levels from last year? And a rain like we had a couple weeks ago where it all goes to low-lying areas, does that benefit the farmer at all, or does that go back into the waterways, or what
happens?
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure about in comparison to last year, but I know that the most of the soil moisture across the state is still a little bit below normal. And I guess that's not too surprising. I guess the main concern would be what's going to happen to all the snow that's on here on the ground right now in terms of how fast does it melt. If it melts slowly, which may be the chance, what's going to cause rapid melting, of course, would be really warm temperatures and rain. And I'm not sure we have rain in the forecast.
We don't.
40-degree weather.
Yeah, we have temperatures in the mid to high 40s by Friday and Saturday. So it could be exactly what we need, this sort of gradual, persistent melt with a little bit of refreeze at the top every night. But that's, that makes it gradual.
Right, good. And that's what we want to get it good. So I would say the outlook looks pretty good for soil moisture with the coming growing season anyway.
Let's hope. Tim in Kenosha, hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I was talking with a farmer, and this has probably been 10, 15 years ago, and he was a third-generation farmer on this property. This was in Iowa. And he was saying that when he took over from his dad was saying, this is a perfect location for farming because you can always count on the weather being the same from one year to the next. And I've been here for about 30 years, and it seems like things were more consistent. Is this actually a fact, or I mean, were things more stable back
30 years ago?
Number of years ago, or is that just our faulty memories?
I'm going to bias my sense towards it's a faulty memory. Though it does depend on exactly where you live. There are places in our own neighborhoods where. And I mean neighborhoods meaning tens to hundreds of miles from here, where the lakes exert such a profound impact on the weather, they really can regulate to some degree what might otherwise be highly variable somewhere farther away from the lake. So there are some of those factors, and so that's why I say it depends exactly on where you live. Same with elevation and valleys and peaks. But I'd say that overall, if you think about North America's weather, I think it would be very difficult to support an argument that says the weather has gotten a lot less stable and a lot more, let's say, varied over the last 30 years as compared to the 30 years prior to that. I don't think you could make that case.
Yeah, he was complaining that things have certainly changed, and that's certainly a ways back further than when we've, been noticing changes here.
Yeah.
Another question, if I could, in regard to insects and pollinators in particular, is this are these swings going to be a significant effect on pollinators and in their coordination with blossoms? Is that, in your mind, a concern?
Boy, that's a good question, and there's a lot of research now looking at the impact of. As the climate is changing and warming up, what is the timing between when food supplies are available and when the people who need that, or the insects or the animals that need that food supply are around? I was talking to somebody about frogs in particular, that frogs were coming out earlier than the insects were coming out now. And that was causing a problem and a stress on the frogs because the food supply isn't there.
Yeah, yep. That's a good point. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We got a Facebook photo that's pretty cool from Tracy, who took this photo at sunset on March 12th after some snow showers. And you see the what looks like the sun, or two pictures of the sun, but neither are the sun. The sun, sun is hidden behind the narrow cloud that's between the two disks. It's a pretty picture. I hope people have a chance to go online to see it. The sun's kind of low. A couple of minutes after the photo, the cloud moved, and a normal sun pillar appeared. Wondering if you could comment on what sort of phenomena this is, and have you seen anything like it where it looks like two suns, and neither one of them are the sun?
Yeah, that I would have guessed, looking at this photo, so if you can't get online, this is kind of what it looks like to me, is that it looks like the sun is above a cloud deck, and then below the cloud deck is a water.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
And then it looks like it, yeah.
But it's not.
But it's not, because you can see the land right below it, the mountain right below it. And so, yeah, I would think it looks like, if you look carefully, at first I thought this was just scattered cloud, but now it looks to me like on the horizon there's a thin cirrus cloud. And then that would generate what we call a sun pillar, which is a reflection of the sun by the ice crystals that are orientated in a certain way, so they act like mirrors. But this is unique in that usually you don't see it as a column. You're seeing spots of the sun, so it must be location of where the clouds are.
Yeah, and also the top part of the first bit of the cloud that you can see, I think it's probably snowing out of that, because this was the day where we had convective snow showers all over the place, and you can have snow falling out of a clear sky on a day like that day. I remember this day well. And so there might even be some, the fact that the pillar is relegated to the lower part of the horizon might be because the snowflakes are actually relegated to the lower part of the horizon at that distance.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, very cool picture. If you're online, go to my Facebook page. It's the title of the page is The Larry Mueller Show, and take a look. We have Sean in Dodgeville with a question. Hi, Sean.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question kind of similar to the previous caller's question about moisture and precipitation. One thing I've noticed, like just traveling around the state, you see like the water levels of lakes and rivers is much lower. Last year was really hot and dry. I was wondering if we're going to be able to make up that precipitation. Will the lake levels kind of getting back to where we're kind of accustomed to seeing them?
Yeah, I don't know if they'll get back up. I'm not sure they'll get back up to what we're accustomed to seeing, but the southern Wisconsin's got is currently above normal in precipitation and snowfall.
That's definitely true.
That's certainly going to help with the inland lakes. I think the Great Lakes are still, particularly Michigan, is still pretty far below normal.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right on both scores, that we've done pretty well precipitation-wise in the cold season, but the lakes, the big lakes, really started out lower, and they have higher demand on them for their water. It's not just natural evaporation and various other things. There's a lot of other things going on around the lakes, that the big lakes, that make it difficult for them to get back to normal.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if the inland lakes kind of start to look a little more normal this year.
Yeah. Alice in Sheboygan, hello.
Hello. I was calling to ask about vegetation, trees, and their effect on temperatures. I remember years ago hearing about a satellite photo that showed the Menominee County or Menominee Indian Reservation was cooler in the summer, that whole county, and warmer in the winter because of the trees.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm concerned because I'm from Sheboygan, but come from the western side of the state, where they're taking a lot of vegetation down with the sand mining. And we plan on doing a big disturbance possibly up north. And I was brought up by an old fisherman who planted trees and helped our trout stream. You know, I was just brought up that way, and I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, vegetation, and you particularly see this in comparison to urban areas where there hasn't been really a lot of vegetation that's replaced by concrete, then those urban areas, in fact, we call it the urban heat islands, that they're generally hotter for a couple of reasons, one of which is that the surrounding area has vegetation, and the vegetation can transpire, and that tends to keep things cooler as water evaporates off things, just like our bodies do. So
go ahead. It's a way we can affect.
Yeah, and in fact,
protection of that.
Yeah, in fact, there's a movement in a lot of cities now to add not only trees but to put vegetation on top of the buildings, and then that way also helps to moderate the temperatures of those urban zones.
Yeah, no doubt that's an important factor. And if you take miles of area that is formerly forested, and you bring it down to the soil. Or the ground, if it's rocky, whatever it might be, you're going to change the geography of that landscape in a significant way, and it'll have long-term impacts locally.
My brother lives over near there, and they've already noticed a change, silt in the air. It's just so different. They've taken down whole ridges that we grew up with to nothing.
Yeah.
And this, I guess I just want to say that I'm concerned about our plans to change things drastically, because we're all looking for water.
Yeah, that's right, or land, or both. And I remember when I was in Washington State as a graduate student, there were, you know, rain in November is a fairly common thing in Western Washington, and heavy rain sometimes. But we found that it was very clear that the rains were not more intense, and they were about normal for some of the Novembers I was there. But the landslides were much more dramatic than they had been in the prior 20 or 30 or 40 years. And the reason was because of development. When you take trees off those hills, there's nothing that keeps the soil on the hill anymore. So this becomes a big deal, how you use the land. Yeah.
Thank you for calling, Alice. Appreciate it. We have a new head of the National Weather Service.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Louis Uccellini, an alumni of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and our department.
That's right. All three of his degrees came from our department, his bachelor's, his master's, his PhD. He's a great guy.
And what does the head of the National Weather Service do?
Right now, he's probably trying to figure out budgets.
Yeah, right. It's all budget stuff. But one of the things maybe people have heard about over the fall and the winter is that the European forecasting enterprise seems to have different strengths compared to the American forecasting enterprise. And that's a function, really, of, I think, long-term hesitation of some of the people in the United States to take full advantage of Steve's enterprise, which is remotely sensing the atmosphere with satellites and ingesting that data into the forecast scheme. Louis is definitely going to be full bore on that. So I think we're going to see that argument kind of disappear, and very quickly. It'll be really exciting. Things like that, major initiatives about how we do our business here.
I think he's got a great balance of, you know, being able to manage a large group, a big budget, and yet really be scientifically involved.
Absolutely. Yeah. The perfect pick.
Yeah. Yep.
Wonderful. Carol in Madison, hi.
Hi. I thought of a second question while I was here, but I'll make it quick. The first one is, we were walking along Lake Mendota's shoreline yesterday.
Yep.
And those ice sheets that come.
Oh, yeah.
That push up on the shore, they're like 4 and 5 feet tall, and they've got huge rocks in them. And we just wondered how quickly that happens and why it happens. And I'll just tell you my second one, and then I'll get off. But we were snowshoeing today in Warner Park, and we just wondered if this was a really hard winter on timber, because everything in there is split from the wind or from the heavy snow this year.
Mm.
And we're just surprised. I think like a third of the lumber in the Warner Park Woods is down.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, we've had a couple of snowfalls, of pretty heavy, wet snowfalls. I mean, just recently.
Right. I'd say our two biggest snowfalls of the whole winter, and it's been nearly a 70-inch snowfall all winter long. The two big ones were December 20th and then the one in early March, and they both were of that concrete, heavy snow stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's sticking around. It's not like it comes off the next day, it seems like, either, which would, again, be breaking limbs off of trees, particularly when wind speeds.
Right, that's right. Yeah. And they both came with pretty decent winds, as a matter of fact, and now you mentioned that. So I think the conditions really were somewhat unusual. We usually get powdery snow up this far north, and we didn't this winter in our two biggest events. So that has something to do with the lumber, I suspect. Then those big sheets of ice on the lake breaks up partly by the currents that are in the lake. They're not Lake Mendota has some currents, very discernible currents, and that can help to break the ice up. And once it starts to break up, these pieces of ice can just start to overlap each other and really get some open space in the lake. It'll get even more dramatic when it really opens up, maybe in the next week or so.
Yeah.
It'll be really dramatic. Football field-sized pieces of ice can come crashing into the shoreline at 1 mile per hour, and it's pretty dramatic right. when you're there watching mm-hmm. it. So it happens fast, but that's really it. The slightest wind will start those big ice floats moving on top of each other.
It's really cool.
Exciting time of year. Yeah.
Yeah. And as somebody who did a lot of ice fishing, I haven't done it so much lately in past years, in near years, being out on a lake like Lake Mendota when the first pressure crack takes off. It is quite an experience.
I bet it is. Yeah.
It is quite an experience because it is loud. It is a cracking thunder. And the ice that's there waves a little bit, almost like a wave.
Yeah. And that's just thermal expansion of the ice, right? Or contracting, either one of those.
It's really something.
And they have ice quakes. I mean, they actually measure them on seismographs on the side of the lake. It's just unreal.
Carol, thanks again. Appreciate it. And Terry in Mellon, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I'm on my way to Brentwood, but I wanted to make a comment about the consistency of the weather. I was at a Midland cooperatives conference back in the 70s. Now, this is 40 years ago, and it's always stuck with me. Larry, what the meteorologist said, we said that the weather the last 50 years had been abnormal and that the next 50 years was going to be normal. And we thought that was kind of a conundrum in that there had always been that consistency in the weather the previous 50 years. But he said that was abnormal in that it was normal and that the weather in the future was going to be normal or abnormal. So we have seen just a variety of weather, and for some reason that meteorologist hit it right on the head back in the mid-70s.
I'm really confused.
He's right, normal or abnormal?
What's normal, what's abnormal?
Normal, I think he was referring to as not much change or not much from one year to the next.
So
unvaried,
right?
And and unvaried, the weather person was saying what people are calling normal was really abnormal. That 50 years in a row, you wouldn't have that much similarity in the weather from one year to the next.
Yeah.
I was wondering about that when the first caller came in and said about 30 years ago, and that is that when we had a decade where there was. I would think normal, non-variable conditions, I should say, was in the 30s, right, when the Dust Bowls were going on.
Yeah.
And then everything was just really dry. But that was, more than 30 years ago.
It was dry
but in the
cold.
70s, it would have been 50 years ago.
In 1936, North Dakota set its all-time high temperature for the state and its all-time low. So I'd say that's highly
true.
Varied.
That's
so
right,
it's,
yeah.
I don't know how to make sense of all this stuff. Yeah. I think that one thing's for sure, in the current glacial age, there's no reason... No prior 10,000-year period where the climate of the Earth has stayed so regular as it has in these 10,000 years. That's true.
Yeah.
But from year to year in a given location, I don't know about that. It's just tricky to know.
Interesting. Thanks, Jerry. Kenny in Wausau. Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I've been listening, and my question, I guess, is, back in the 70s, I remember it seemed like you'd get a sunny day and the heat from the sun didn't seem so intense as it does now. But I'm looking at, every morning they show the record high and lows, and they go back, in like an almanac, and you're looking at records that, if they break a record, the record's 100 years old. A lot of them.
Yeah, we haven't broken too many, and actually we just looked at this recently.
Yeah.
Because we haven't broken too many high records.
No, lows.
We've broken a lot of low records.
No.
It's
the other way
around.
Over the last 10 or 20 years.
We've set more records associated with high lows. So in other words, the low temperature is a record high record low.
And also some daily maximum. So any way you measure it. So that's one way you can measure an all-time high for
but not
the lowest
record
temperature
low
today.
Temperatures.
Yeah, it's 2-1 or more than 2-1
yeah.
in favor of high temperature records, not low temperature records. We don't break low temperature records anymore.
Yeah.
It's very unusual.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you have it.
Well, okay.
So, yeah, but now that's not related to the sun.
That's
we didn't
right.
talk about the sun's output.
Let's talk about that next.
Because the sun's output varies, on like an 11-year cycle in terms of how much energy it puts out. But generally, that's so small that I don't think you would recognize that in terms of, us as human bodies feeling it.
A couple of watts per meter squared, right?
Yeah,
out
right,
of
which is pretty small.
So.
Yeah,
that's a small fraction.
And over an 11-year period, you wouldn't have that. I mean, our bodies are really good at sensing short-time changes.
Mm.
You know, so if the temperature drops 20 degrees in a day, we really notice it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Over a season, we don't really.
Yeah.
And, well, aren't we going to have more bursts from the sun? We're going to get.
Yeah, so we're on that cycle now where the energy output of the sun is going up.
Yeah.
So compared to early 2000s in particular, or late 2000, 2008, 2009, we're seeing a much more active sun.
So we're going to.
And that's
more...
why you see reports of aurora borealis.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't
Northern
see those five, six
that's
years
true.
Ago.
Yeah, they were absent completely, weren't they?
Yeah.
So it's a good time to be on that Northern Lights, that aurora borealis list.
Right. Yeah, to get those warnings.
Well, guys, boy, the time flew.
It did. Good.
You're going to come back and be with us again, I hope, next Monday or next month.
Hopefully it'll be warmer. Unless we get stuck in the ice outside.
I'll guarantee you there won't be any snow on the ground that last Monday of April.
And what did you do for this what did you do for the spring forecast?
Again? I did say it would yes, thank you for clarifying. I did say I agreed with the groundhog for reasons that were much more scientific than and some furry
but you're both
swirl
wrong,
seeing
though.
A shadow. But yeah, wrong. I did think it would be an earlier spring, but wrong.
Our weather guys will be back the last Monday of next month. Stay with us. There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.